This is Follow Spot, San Diego Theater Scene's bi-weekly podcast focused on the people who make theater in San Diego County, with news, views, and conversation to inform you of what's happening in San Diego's exciting theater community. And now here is your host, Dale Morris.
All right, welcome to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot podcast. I'm sitting here with Michael Thomas Tower and Kelly Lepchinski. My name is Dale Morris. Welcome for another chat about theater in San Diego. Today, we're at noon, we've got Rich Carrillo and Glenn Beddington.
Mm-hmm.
Who have we got after that, Kelly?
After that, New Village Arts is coming. We've got Christiane Kerner and Joshua Everett Johnson.
We've got some good guests today. You know, New Village Arts for years have been one of the preeminent smaller theaters in the San Diego area. Of course, I think of them as being in the San Diego area, mm-hmm. but they're
Carlsbad,
actually
yeah.
Carlsbad. I mean, it's still 30 miles.
Right.
You know, it's not
right.
like it's not like it's that far of a drive.
It is farther than it used to be, though.
But
with
it's
the gas prices.
But a really nice theater space they've got up there
beautiful.
In the Carlsbad Village. It's a lovely place, right off the trolley stop or the coaster stop. It's a really nice space, and they do some good work up there. I mean, I've seen a couple things up there. They're doing Fool for Love right now. That's getting really great reviews.
Yes, it is.
And they're going to talk about that a little bit when they're here.
Well, I feel so fortunate to have them with us today. And obviously, part of my heart to have Rich Carrillo and Glenn Beddington here, the stars of the show Britannicus that opens at Compass Theater here in for previews on the 16th. So having them here, I play a small role in that show myself. So it's going to be fun chatting with them. And Kelly, I mean, you're producing a show right now.
I am. I'm at Scripps Ranch Theater producing The Last Night of Ballyhoo. They've got a pretty good cast going with that one as well. Tim Irving is directing, and Jill Drexler's in the show. So is Dana Hooley and Danny Campbell. And
ooh, good
Danae
cast.
Danae Steele, Morgan Trant.
Yeah, Morgan.
And Jude Evans and Alex Chernow. I named everybody else. Got to name them as well.
All right, good. Hey, you know what? Isn't producing fun?
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea what I was getting into. The only other thing I've produced was, of course, my festival, and I didn't have sets and publicity photographs. And a lot of the things I'm dealing with now are kind of like, wow, okay, this is work.
Yeah, I always enjoy it when I walk in and see another producer and have a chance to talk with them and and see the crinkles around their eyes and the steam coming out of their ears. Yes, I enjoy that because now you know what I've been going through for 7.5 years.
Absolutely.
2 shows a week.
The number of people who need the number of different things is amazing.
Yeah, you wonder why I'm just a little bit crazy. Of course, a lot of people would say I'm a lot crazy, but producing theater is one of the worst jobs on the face of the earth.
And there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
And then you don't even really get to feel that pride at the end, because it's really the director's work, the actors.
Yeah, you're a gopher is what you are, you know. You're just a gopher. At any given time, I've got 2 shows running. I have 2 shows in rehearsal, and I'm thinking about 2 shows that are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hell. It is absolutely hell to go through
yeah.
and be a producer. So, children out there, you know, there's, you know, I would say plastics.
Don't grow up to be a producer.
No, I would say go into the stock market.
Plastics.
You know, I would say become president of the United States. I would say do anything, but don't be a producer of theater.
That's right.
Unless you're very wealthy.
Now, I have heard it said that actors in their homes hang pictures of themselves, and producers hang Picassos. I think you got to be on Broadway for that to be
exactly.
That's another level.
Exactly. Small theater producers are like gophers. You know, we're like slaves. We're like idiots.
But by goodness, are we organized and going to get it done.
Yeah, but it's show business.
<That's right.
laughs> If it fails, it's your fault.
Exactly.
But if it succeeds, it's everybody
else's. It's the director. It's everybody else. We did it in spite of Dale.
That's right.
Anyway, and of course, we are being serious about that. Now, Michael Tower is a playwright and a music writer, and he's got a play about to open at Compass Theater as well, called Backwater Blues. Michael, how's that going?
Going very well, and actually that's not the only play it's about to open. Kelly is directing another of my plays will be going up in a few days with your girlfriend, Jamie Lloyd.
Yay, Jamie.
In one of the roles over at North Park Vaudeville and Candy Shop. Their festival starts, it's already in progress.
It's in progress. There were six different shows each weekend, and this weekend, as we are recording, will be the third weekend. The following weekend, their fourth and final, is the weekend Knowing When goes up.
All right,
so
get
the
out 24th,
there, 25th.
Get out there to the North Park Vaudeville and Candy Shop. Buy some candy and see a show. And one thing I'm really looking forward to seeing, and I got to see it before it closes, is Dying City out at Signet with Sean Cox and Christy Yale. I hope I'm saying her name right. What else is playing around town you got to see?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff going
Light
on.
And
it all closes
still
about the same time. Yeah. The Women and Back at the Globe. Yeah. I think they both close on the 26th. Dying City closes on the 26th. I believe Fool for Love also closes around that time. So there's a lot. There's a lot going on coming to an end right about now. So there's going to be a new spring awakening, so to speak.
All right. Stick with us. We're going to take a break and come back. And when we come back, we will have Rich Carrillo and Glenn Beddington, two very fine actors who star in the show Britannicus, written by Jean Racine.
I don't know.
Translated Johann Racine. It's Johann Racine. Rossini. Johann Rossini. And translated by our good friend at Compass Theater, Howard Rubenstein. So we'll be back to talk to them in just a few minutes. Stay with us. This is San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast.
In a stark motel room on the desert's edge, two lovers battle obsession, jealousy, a fractured past, and each other in one night of hand-to-hand, heart-to-heart combat which lays bare the primal drive which makes us all fools for love. Pulitzer Prize-nominated, Obie Award-winning, vicious, erotic, and funny, Sam Shepard's Fool for Love plays October 4th through 26th at New Village Arts in Carlsbad. For reservations, call 760-433-3245 or visit newvillagearts.org.
Welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast. I'm sitting with Kelly Lepchinski and Michael Thomas Tower, and our guests for this segment are Glenn Beddington and Rich Carrillo, who are the stars of Britannicus, which opens at Compass Theater. It opens for previews on the 16th. It opens for general audiences on the 23rd. Is it the 23rd, Glenn?
I think that is the 23rd, yes. Glenn, yes, it is the 23rd,
it's
Thursday.
The 23rd, yeah. So everybody come out and see Britannicus at Compass Theater. Glenn, the last show you were in was The Boise Inheritance at Lamb's Players. That's a great group to work for, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that was a David Mamet translation. Could you tell that it was Mamet?
That's very interesting, because a lot of people who came to see the show would ask that question. What we're looking for, the sensibility of Mamet,
or the voice, or the
voice, you know, of the energy. And I would have to say that what he did, which was lovely, is he took a play which had too many characters for our time period. It was wonderful 100 years ago, but today it had too many characters, and it had and it was too long, and it was too preachy. And what he did is he slimmed it down. So from the standpoint of his voice, it came in the way that he slimmed it down, the way that he took out unnecessary characters and really made it a much clearer, more precise, pointed story than it was originally.
Yeah, that's an unusual play for him to do. We're doing two of his plays at Compass this year. We're doing American Buffalo, yep, directed by Ruff Yeager, which opens in January, and we're doing Boston Marriage, which took me about 2 or 3 years to get the rights for, and his writing is so clear. I mean,
yes,
you read the script and you go, this is Mamet, or it's Mamet-like, or something. So it's interesting that he can take an old play like that and you not see that.
Well, I think you do see it if you understand Mamet.
Yeah.
And for me, what's clear, always clear about Mamet is the music.
Yeah, and really, all the FUs in it.
That too. Yeah. Which there were none in this one. But the rhythm and the music, the way that he moves toward certain points, it's very clear what he's saying. And I would have to say that to a certain degree was in the in the way that he cut everything down.
Yeah, now I don't know if this is a fair question or
adaptation, really. It's not a translation.
Yes, I don't know if this is a fair question, but how do you compare that dialogue with the poetry or the lyricism in, say, Britannicus?
Ah, interesting. Well, okay, stepping back from the question just for a second, I would say that every written piece has a poetry to it, has a rhythm to it, if you will. And it really is about finding what that rhythm is in the piece. And then within each character, I believe there's also a rhythm and a flow that goes along with each particular character. And part of being an actor is discovering what that is for yourself, what words are emphasized often, what is the rhythm, what is the attack, what is the flow, whatever, any of that. So from that standpoint, because they're plays, there's going to be something to compare. Specifically looking at Britannicus, it is written in, not in verse per se, but it is written as poetry, as free-form, free-flowing poetry, so it's going to have that rhythm. And because there's the rhythm to it, and also because the intention was not to do it as a piece that separates us from the audience,
yes,
but instead to connect us,
yes,
to the audience,
yes.
So the rhythm is there, but we don't need to emphasize it.
Yeah,
we don't
need
to talk about it. We don't need to, you know, play it. We just, it's there. It's underneath everything that you say.
It is, and I'll bet that is a similar concept or performance in The Voice of the Inheritance. That rhythm is there.
It's there. It's
just
going
in
to
a
be
different
there.
Form.
Absolutely. And so it's a matter of discovering it, finding it, and using it or working against it.
Yeah. Rich, I'm going to include
better.
You in just a second.
a
final question until I turn to Rich. Now, in learning these fabulous monologues that you have in Britannicus.
Mm.
The play was written by, I call him Jean Racine, but I suppose it's Jean Racine. Translated beautifully by Howard Rubinstein. Do you learn it in that rhythm? Does that rhythm help you to learn those lines?
Yes, absolutely. Because for me, in memorizing anything, but particularly in this, it's, for me, it's finding out what am I saying here, and that's how the rhythm supports me, because I can understand in the same way that you go to Shakespeare and it's very clear based on the rhythm, what is he trying to say? What is the word that he's really looking to have emphasized? And so in doing this piece, it was the same way. What is it that he's trying to say here? And then once I know what he's trying to say, then I can figure out how he's saying it, which means using the exact words.
I'm going to chat with Rich for a moment. I wonder, would you do one of your monologues for us? If you would think about it, and if one comes to mind, if you would do one of your monologues,
great.
It would
all
be
right,
wonderful.
Thank you.
I just put her terribly on the spot there. We've done that before here, and it's just wonderful.
Great.
Rich, I'm so excited to have you in this cast at Compass Theater. You just closed in Streetcar Named Desire, where you played a really fine role. You were in Corpus Christi at Diversionary. You're cast in The Cripple of Inishman at Ion Theater in February. What's it like to play, among all those characters, what's it like to play Nero?
Nero, so far, I think, has probably been one of the most exciting, I think the most fun characters to play. He is such an eccentric, such an erratic guy, almost bipolar, I guess. And through my own research and looking through historical documents and things like that about the man, he was just such an interesting young man. He his whole rise to power through the help of his mother and through his adoption through the prior emperor Claudius, he kind of fell into his place by accident almost. And with him being such an eccentric, artistic kind of person, he loved to perform, he loved to act, sing, write poetry, and all these things. I really, really loved being able to dive into that whole aspect of the character and really embrace that and bring all that into Nero, bring that to the forefront, I guess, more than anything else. The man was always performing, I guess, in a sense, throughout in his everyday life.
And you know what I didn't know? I didn't know that during the early part of his reign, he was actually a good guy.
And he was, yes. And that's what this, in the story of Britannicus, that we do get to see. He is known for being one of the most tyrannical emperors to ever rule Rome. But
later in his reign,
yes. But this story kind of gives you, it points you, or shows you the reasons why he became who he was, who he was known as.
Yeah.
Through all the intrigue and with the power struggles going on within.
Yeah,
Rome,
his mother,
and with his advisors, and especially his mother, who was an extremely powerful force.
Agrippina, played by Glenn.
Played by Glenn, yes, who does that beautifully. With the power struggle going on there within Rome, and him trying to balance all that, he kind of, and with his own eccentric, you know, personality and behavior, he just really didn't know what to do. Didn't know where to go. He was a young man as well, so he really
and
wasn't
totally controlled by his mother.
Very much so. I think him.
I mean, he wouldn't even let her in the room.
That's true. That is true. Yes, but I think where by him doing what he did, by him for being known for what he was as being this tyrant, I think he had to take that route to try to break away from the grasp that his mother had on him. He had to prove to everyone and to himself that he had control, that he was the emperor, that he ruled Rome, and no one could take that away from him. So he had to do what he had to do, and unfortunately, he is known as being a horrible person. But hopefully, in this show, you'll get to see that, you know, maybe
there's more than one side to
exactly,
every story.
Yes.
The mother is such a controlling woman. I've known you for a while. It's such a different character for you. What's it like to play this kind of role?
It's wonderful. Are you kidding? That's wonderful to be able to. There's so much for her to chew on with her. It's marvelous. And what I was going to say is that I am a parent of teenagers. I have a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I've seen the different stages. And Nero is not much past a teenager.
Yeah, what is he, 20, 21?
20s, yeah.
Right, exactly. He's a young man. He's been through all of this. As being a parent of a teenager, I know that one of the things that we learn is how to be able to choose your battles. You know, which ones are you going to push and what ones are you going to really let them win? Because otherwise, they're going to fight. They're not going to win, you're not going to win. It's going to be terrible. And I think that's the big problem between this mother-son relationship is that mom really didn't know how to choose her battles. Because it was a country that he was ruling, and she was trying to say, listen, I know how to do this, let me just do it, or why don't you hurry up and learn? And of course he couldn't, and he wants to do it his own way. So there's such incredible battle, but it's specifically to answer your question, it's a wonderful role to play.
Yeah, of course it is wonderful. But you know, your mom and dad live out in Colorado, right?
Yes.
Did you ever, dealing with your own parents, have to deal with kind of issues?
Definitely, yes. I am, and I have brought a lot of my relationship with my mother and father to Nero and his relationship with his mother. Now, like, not to say I don't have great parents.
Yeah.
I have wonderful parents, and I love them immensely. But growing up, and I did grow. I have an older brother and a younger brother, so I kind of that whole middle child syndrome thing. Yeah. I thought that was not me. That I did not have. I've learned as I've grown older that maybe I did fall into that.
Yeah.
There was some. I guess, jealousy towards my brothers at times when I felt like I was kind of being put on the back burner when they were allowed to do whatever they wanted or whatever. And I held a little, I guess, at a young age, some resentment towards my parents for that, which I've, of course, got over since then. But, yes.
Well, what's so terrible, hitchhiking on what you're saying, he and Britannicus, Nero and Britannicus, grew up together.
Yes.
They were half-brothers. And, you know, it's not a secret. I'm not giving away anything to say, you know, Nero eventually kills his brother.
wow. Yeah, really. And that's definitely taking it to a different other level than, you know, it would go in, I guess, in any other circumstance. But, no, and that's jealousy that I felt towards Britannicus because of the way my mother Agrippina was, you know, the things that were going on between the two of them that she was hiding from Nero.
She had to do these things to save her own life.
To protect herself, yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it wasn't just making him a better emperor that was at her goal, but it was her life, her own life. Absolutely.
Yeah. So with this script, Rich, what was it like to dive into this character, to read that poetry? And I think it's fair. I mean, it's written as poetry, even though when I listen to you guys say it on stage, it doesn't sound like poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was the first thing I noticed definitely when I read it. And I had also previously in February did another one of Howard Rubinstein's.
Oh, that's right.
Tony and Cleo. Yes, where I played Mark
the most
Anthony.
Successful off-night show in the history of Sixth at Penn Theater.
That was nice, and we had a great cast and a great director and a great script, so that all helped out definitely. But coming into this play, and I knew somewhat to expect that type of language when I first began this process. But through our director Miriam Cooperman, the way she wanted it played out was more along the lines of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, which starred Leonardo DiCaprio, how it was, they used Shakespeare's language, but they spoke it in a more modern,
contemporary
way. Yes. Yeah. So basically I just try to absorb as much.
What's funny is the rhythm's still there.
Rhythm is still there. Yeah. It is still there. But yeah, I definitely try to take it in and just speak as I would speak normally. But yeah, you can't escape completely the poetry that comes along with it. So
we're talking about the show Britannicus that opens for previews October 16th and for general audiences on October 23rd at Compass Theater. You can go to compasstheater.com to buy tickets, or you can call 619-688-9210. Now, I'm going to change the subject here. Just real briefly, I know that you're doing The Cripple of Inishman. That's a new play, actually. It's been on Broadway. It's new to the rest of the country by Martin McDonagh. It's being directed by Glenn Paris. You've just been cast. That opens in February.
It opens in February, yes. I'll be playing the part of Bobby in that show. I was recently cast, so I'm not sure exactly who has all been cast, and I haven't even received the script yet, so I have really no idea what's going on with that, but I'm definitely excited about this show. It's a great piece.
Well, Ion Theater is doing some of the best work in San Diego right now. Everybody says that, and it's true. You know, even when you go see one of their shows that you don't necessarily like it, maybe, you still look at the set, you look at the planning, you look at the acting, you look at the directing, and you just go, wow, every single show that they do. And then after that, what are your plans?
I am planning on moving up to Los Angeles sometime mid-2009 to pursue more film television, so that's my next step. Hopefully good things will happen there, and I definitely want to stick with theater as long as possible and continue to come back, but I definitely, my aim is to do more work in film and television. So.
Well, I think you're a shoo-in.
Well, thanks.
Now, Glenn, back in the 80s, you had, you and your husband, Paul, actually had Ensemble Arts Theater.
Right. We started in 89, so we went for 10 years, went to 99. And, we started out doing, we weren't sure what we were going to do when we first started out. We just had a group of people and wanted to do theater, and we said, okay, let's start. So the first show we did was a play called Tracers, which had been created by a group of Vietnam veterans. Mm-hmm. When they came back, it was their way. They were actors, and they created this piece, and we did that. Very quickly, we decided to go to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, which was because Paul and I had actually been there on our honeymoon in the mid-80s, and we decided to take a group. So we went and we took a play called Angel City by Sam Shepard to that and had a great time. It was outrageous for anybody that's ever been to the festival. You know, the 1,200 pieces of theater playing in a three-week period of time, and you go from... 8 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in the morning seeing theater. So, and it's a big deal. So we went, and the following year we took another couple of shows. By that point, we had seen so many new shows that we decided what we really wanted our focus to be was primarily new work. And the idea was to cross-pollinate, to be able to bring work that we, you know, could get from companies that we'd met in other places other than the United States here and send our work there. That was really the goal. To some degree, we were successful. We did a lot of work here. We didn't have too much done over there. but we did quite a bit of work, and it was very interesting. And working with new plays for that long, I learned huge amounts. I directed a lot of the pieces that we did, not all, but a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting.
10 years is a long time.
Yeah, it is.
Glenn, we were talking about you doing a bit of a monologue. Would you do a monologue for us from the show?
Yes, yes. This is the one and only time that, well, that's not true, the first time that Nero and his mother finally get to see each other. Okay. Come, dear, give your mother a kiss. Good. Now a hug. All right, then. Boris says you intend to tell me what I've done to make me a prisoner. Allow me to tell you the crime I've committed. Allow me to enlighten you. You reign, my darling. Now I should like to remind you how it's come about that you are emperor.
By golly, that's pretty good.
I mean, we could have gone better.
You had me.
It's all right.
I was following right along. That was very good. Glenn, thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you guys in Britannicus very soon.
All right.
An evening of vintage horror, sex, and humor marks the first full production for Kronos Theatre with An Evening at the Grand Guignol at the Neurosciences Institute on John Jay Hopkins Drive, October 7th, 8th, and 9th at 8 p.m. For reservations and information, call 619-615-8926 or visit chronostheater.com, C-H-R-O-N-O-S, theater.com.
All right, welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Foul Spot Podcast. That was fun having Rich Carrillo and Glenn Beddington here with us. I'm sitting with Kelly Lipchinsky and Michael Tower. And our guests for this segment are Joshua Everett Johnston and Christiane Kerner, the powers behind the power at New Village Arts. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. You're doing a play right now that is close to my heart, Fool for Love, mm-hmm. by Sam Shepard. It closes, I think you told me, on the 26th. How can somebody get a ticket for Fool for Love?
You can go on our website, which is the easiest way, which is newvillagearts.org, O-R-G. Or you can always call our box office at 760-433-3245.
Yeah, I was telling the story before we went on the air that when I was 35 years old, many, many years ago, I got cast as the old man in Fool for Love, and I went up to the director one day and I said, so should I put some powder or some gray in my hair, some lines on my face? And he just goes, no, you're fine. It was
Thank
awful.
You,
yeah, exactly. But Fool for Love, and in the stage direction at the front of the play, this play is to be done relentlessly without a break. Mm-hmm. It's one of the best stage directions I've ever seen, Josh. Mm. Yeah, what's it like to play that character?
It's relentless. Yeah. I mean, definitely. It's a lot of fun, first of all, and it was a big challenge. You know, there's a lot of cowboy in him, you know, and actually went out and trained with a cowgirl, learned how to rope, and rode some horses, which was great for me, you know. And then my obvious attraction to, and our, I think, as a company attraction to Sam Shepard is also there, just the writing, the humanity of it all, and the storytelling, which is, in my opinion, a master storyteller, you know. And then for me also, just on a personal note, as far as choosing the characters and the shows and stuff like that, it's really fun to play a man my own age, you know, which is great for me. I get cast quite often as young, which I love, and it's great, like a lot of coming-of-age stories and things like that. So for me, it's just really fun to, you know, step into the boots, so to speak, of a man my own age who's, you know, and play a man, a cowboy, no less, which is just a blast.
We'll come back to that character. Just a brief aside, a question. Sam Shepard, his humanity and his writing, you're so attracted to. Where do you put him in the, you know, if we were doing a, what do you call that, Mount, where they've got all the faces.
Mount Rushmore,
yeah. whose faces would be up there besides, you know, Sam Shepard's?
Besides Sam Shepard's? Yeah. Oh, let's see. Eugene O'Neill, Clifford Odets, Edward Albee, Tennessee Williams.
David Mamet, maybe.
David Mamet, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's some pretty strong company. So I know you, didn't you guys do Lie of the Mind?
This is our fourth Shepard. So we did Lie of the Mind and Curse of the Starving Class with Signet Theater, and then True West last year as well.
Yeah, you know, I heard that with Lie of the Mind that he showed up at the first rehearsal with 9 pages of dialogue.
Really?
Yeah, 9 pages of dialogue, and then they just started. Improvising, and went from there. He's an incredible character. What do you think about May?
Oh,
what
I
is
love
the
her.
Deal with May?
Oh, I love her. She's, you know, one of the things I love so much about her is she's in this crazy, insane situation, but she keeps fighting. She keeps trying for more.
You're
no gonna
matter make
what.
Me disappear. What's that line? You're gonna,
you're gonna erase me. You're gonna erase me. Take me out of this world. But yeah, I think she has this situation that she's found herself in for a good part of her life that that she has no control over, but that she's going to keep trying to do something about. And that's what I love. It's she never gives up.
Yeah.
There's never a moment of totally giving up on things. It's always, we're going to keep trying one way or the other. We're going to keep going.
That's pretty typical Sam Shepard, too. And another thing is, with the father, the old man in the play, mm-hmm. Sam writes a lot about his father, doesn't he? Mm-hmm.
He does, and this play, he's actually, he's half in and half out, and depending on the interpretation, but mostly you can recognize in the play and in the stage directions that he, Eddie obviously is the only one who talks directly to the father mm-hmm. figure, you know, and he's, although he's in a lot of the plays, I mean, even obviously True West, Curse of the Starving Class, he's actually present.
Oh, what's the other one?
Buried Child.
Yes, but the long title, Nick Nolte.
The late Henry Moss.
This one,
he's actually on stage with you. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's, it's that father. It's the Shepherd father figure, absolutely.
All right, so you've got to get out to see Fool for Love soon. Because it closes on October 26th, and it's a unique opportunity to see Sam Shepard really from the inside out. I think
I think it's one of the clearest of Shepard's plays too. I know we've had a lot of people who've been coming to the theater for years and have seen most of the works that we've done, especially the Shepard stuff, and they say, you know, this one is one of the clearest. It's you know, you start, it's relentless, but it's also more clear. You can follow it, you can understand what's going on really, really easily, because it's very primal. It's at the guts of everything. So
get out there and see that play just as quickly as you can. You can go to newvillagearts.com
or org.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Is there a number they could call to?
760-433-3245.
Tell us what's coming up, Christina.
Great. What we have next is a return to our holiday show. We commissioned this last year, the world premiere, and it's written by local playwrights Amy Keeney and Tom Zohar, and it's called Off the Ground.
Now, you did this show last year, so it's got to be pretty good for you to bring it back.
Yeah, we do love it. It's the dysfunctional family Christmas, you know, story, but it's told in its own unique way, and I think only in the way that Tom and Amy could tell it, and it really, again, embraces the actors, and that's one of the things we're really centered around at New Village Arts is the actors. and we have a fabulous cast, a couple new additions this year that we're thrilled about. And again, it's just one of those plays that I love to sit and watch because every character is so unique and so interesting, yeah. And you get involved in the story so much that it's just a joy.
And the characters are so unique, and at the same time, you know, you walk out of there, and I mean, every show, every single show last year, it was someone would say, "Oh, that's my aunt," or "Oh, that's my sister." "Oh man, that's my father-in-law." You know,
and it's I gotta go call my mom.
Yeah, without being written cliche, it has that really kind of ring true family dynamic in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. You know, a question just came up in my mind. Now, if you had to give New Village Arts a subtitle, you know, edgy theater, blah, 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 what would it be?
Intense actor-driven ensemble theater.
Intense actor-driven ensemble theater.
You've said actor-driven many, many mm-hmm. times. How are you distinguishing actor-driven from other theaters? What does that mean to you?
To me, it's a real respect for what the actor brings to a show. So that I wouldn't say that we're a director-heavy company, and that we really want to welcome what each unique actor brings to what they're doing. And again, theater as a collaborative art, I think one of the ways that we make it an art is by welcoming what each individual brings to the play and to the production. And so that we give a lot of time and attention to what each individual actor is going to bring to us. And we purposefully encourage them to bring as much as they possibly can. And I think by doing so, you get the best performances of the whole play. Because again, when it's truly collaborative and you truly have everybody giving to it, you have a really great...
I don't mean to dissect it, but you give them a lot of time. What does that mean?
It means that when you come into rehearsals for New Village Arts, you're not going to be told where to move right away. You're not going to be told how to play your role. We're going to give you some time to figure that out. We're going to give you guidelines, and we're going to do all kinds of things to help you find your way there. And as directors, we're going to come in and tell the story. But what I view, and I know Joshua feels the same way, is that as directors, the first few weeks are there to build those actors and to build that ensemble and to let those actors bring what they're going to bring. And then the director's job really comes in even more as far as shaping the play and telling the story and making the stage pictures and all of that. It comes in a little bit later. It's not going to be there on the first day. We're going to give those actors that chance
improv-
to find their
work and yeah. that sort of thing. Yeah.
Now really that's good. Really nice because a lot of directors really, if you have a 7-person play, they want 7 little themselves on the stage.
Yeah. And so, I don't think that works. I think that's when you lose theater as an art. I think that's when it becomes puppet. You know, not nothing wrong with puppetry, but I mean, it becomes where there's one person in charge of everything rather than everybody bringing mm-hmm. what they have, and that's what makes theater an art
yeah.
form to
and
me.
When actors are really going after something, and they start to when you rehearse that way, at least we find they start to really invest themselves in what they're going after. So there's this genuine kind of core that's coming across on stage that you might not get if they're doing it because they think they understand the role and the director and everything looks good and it's fine, you know. But when you really get down to a deeper understanding of the text or whatever, and you start to invest yourself, then every argument you have with your lover or your father or your sister or whatever the case may be. All of a sudden you find yourself, because we all are actors by nature already, you find yourself invested in this, and those real moments start to happen.
And how does improv, for example, help that process?
I think when you break down a script and you say maybe you get a couple of lines as posts, you know, and then you improv the situation, through a course of improvising the situation, you become real clear on what you understand about mm-hmm. the situation and what you don't understand about the situation, what you understand and what you don't understand about what you want, who you are, where you are, becomes real clear when the text is taken away from you and you're left with the bones of the situation.
Yeah, I hope that listeners over time will go to our website where we have these podcasts, and they'll go to the different guests that we have who talk about these techniques, who talk about playwriting, who talk about these inner important things, because they can learn so much. You know, from what I'm hearing you guys talk about, it's just it's a wonderful. You can learn a lot by listening to these people. Well, you guys hold classes, don't you? You have.
We have for a while. We're actually taking a break on that right now. We'll probably get classes going in again a little bit later. But we kind of are focusing more right now on our ensemble development, on our staff development. We've just hired a bunch of new people, which we're thrilled about. We have a new full-time managing director. We hired a new technical director. Joshua coming on full-time. Yeah. We upped the hours for our box office manager. So we're growing a lot right now. And we have a lot of internal growth and a lot of things that we're working on the business side of the theater, yeah, to really get that as stable and strong as our production side is.
Yeah, well, let's talk about your ensemble for a minute, and mm-hmm. then I want to talk about your upcoming shows. Mm-hmm. Who are the members? As long as it's not 30 of them.
We have a 14-member ensemble.
Yeah, and I forgive us if any names are forgotten, but who are those folks?
Okay, here we go. We have Amanda Sitton, Amanda Morrow, Jack Missett, Tom Zohar, Adam Brick, Manny Fernandez, Rachel Van Warmer, Joshua, me. Oh my gosh.
Sandra
Ellis Troy.
Dana Case, did we say?
We didn't say Dana yet. Somebody's going to kill me.
Wendy,
yes.
That's 12, right?
There. And two mystery
more
people.
Darren Scott.
Oh, my.
And Ron Chilartin.
There we go.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, what a incredible ensemble. I mean, that's an incredible ensemble. Now, mm-hmm. how do you guys work together? I mean, how does that work? Do you call everybody in every once in a while and go, okay, we're a team here?
We do different things. We had an ensemble retreat where we actually all went away, imagine that, for a weekend, and got together and tried to kind of, you know, settle what it is that this ensemble does. And we also have monthly ensemble meetings that not everybody can come to every time, and that's fine, but it gives us a chance to all get together, share what we're doing, talk some philosophy if we want to, do some exercise work, things like that, just to keep everybody moving and working towards what this means. We're really working this year on what it means to be an ensemble theater and what that ensemble means. And so we're working with the whole group.
Boy, that's an important mission. That's mm-hmm. an important thing to come to. I mean, you got to know what it is that you're working toward.
Yeah.
So tell me about the shows that are coming up after Off the Ground.
After Off the Ground. In February, we're going to be doing the regional premiere of Issa Davis's Bull Rusher. Bull Rusher was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in 2007, and I actually went to grad school with Issa, so I'm thrilled to be doing her play. She's on Broadway right now in Passing Strange, and she plays Stu's mom. But the play is an absolutely beautiful look at identity and race and sexuality, and it's.
Is she African American?
She is, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of the most beautiful plays I've ever written. I did not write it. I've ever read.
Why? Why?
She mixes a poetic style with a realistic style. It's definitely magical realism. And she's also, the town that it takes place in is a town up in Northern California that actually created its own language. So the language is a musical language, and it's not even the way that we normally speak. It's called bootling, and it's just the whole way that it's brought up is very, Issa is also a musician, a very accomplished musician. And so the whole play has a musicality to it. There's a river on stage, which I can't wait to build, so that the atmosphere that it's in is also really beautiful, but it mixes both. You know, Sandra Ellis Troy is playing a madam in it. Half of it takes place in a whorehouse, as well as the river, as well as all these different places. So it's just a gorgeous
exciting.
Play.
Yeah. And who's directing that?
I'm directing
You're
that
directing
one.
That.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's my baby.
I can't wait to see that. And then what?
And then we're going to Annie Weissman's Be Aggressive. Which was done at the La Jolla Playhouse back in 2001 and was actually submitted by one of our ensemble members. We encourage our ensemble to submit plays to us. And I had never seen it or read it. I didn't see it when it was here. And I read it, and Joshua read it, and we both fell in love with it. And I think, you want to take it?
Yeah, sure. It's a big surprise. I mean, like 3 pages in, you know, you get those scripts, and 3 pages in, you've gotten some kind of an impression. And my impression was just, wow, you know, like... Like, they handed me a script, and they said, oh, here, read the scripts about cheerleaders.
Yeah, boy. I can't wait to take that one home.
So you do realize this is New Village Arts, right? I mean, right, you know? And I read it, and it was so, A, funny, and B, poignant, and so relevant to this time and place without trying too hard. I mean, it's just hilarious and smart and real witty and real now, which is something that I love. To include in the season, it's something that current musicians do well and current storytellers do well is to have something in the season that really speaks to what it feels like to live where we are, when we are.
And also, it did killer business, as I recall, at La Jolla Playhouse, and there's no reason for it not to.
Yeah, it's a fun show. It's I mean, it's really so moving, great. Too. It's really
Yeah, the writing is really sparkling.
Yeah,
really
well, you know, she's becoming a successful playwright.
Oh, yes,
I mean,
definitely.
She's she has a working great voice. A lot. Yeah.
Great voice.
And then what?
And then we're finishing the season with, we're going back to John Patrick Shanley, one of our other favorite playwrights, and we're going to Hollywood for Four Dogs and a Bone. And Joshua's directing that, so I'll let him. I'll let you take that one too, if you want.
I was just too tempting to pass up. I mean, it's a laugh out loud script, and I think too at the time, it just seemed, and I, you know, and it's risky and it's hilarious and it's and the characters are real gritty Hollywood folk. I mean, they're not out there to apologize for themselves. No. So really, it's a real hard look at Hollywood. But at the same time,
after
it's just hilarious.
Was that after Speed the Plow? Was that before or after Speed the Plow?
I'm not sure.
Honestly,
actually.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either.
But if you like Entourage, you'll like this one.
Yeah,
it's definitely it's for just outlandish characters. And again, you know, there's a quote in it. I forget who. From which publication, you know, from Los Angeles or New York, but it says if you're going to write, basically I'm paraphrasing, of course, but if you're going to write about Hollywood at this late date, it better be really, really funny, and it is.
Yeah,
it's really,
yeah,
it's really
it's
that
a funny,
funny
show.
So.
And Shanley, boy, what a fine playwright he is. We didn't put him on the mountain.
No, he's consider him on the mountain.
Yeah, he's
was
working his way up
too.
The mountain. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think. Doesn't he have a show on Broadway right now?
Yeah, he has. It's called Romantic Poetry.
I know nothing about
it's
it.
It's brand new. Yeah, I know it's. I think this is the one that's the musical that he did because he was working on two. One was a musical and one was. And I think Romantic Poetry is the musical, but that's all I know about it right
Good
now.
Good luck with that. Now, do you have any future thoughts about other shows you're going to do?
Oh, we always have lots of thoughts about that. But
well, which one of them can I steal from you?
Yeah, wait a second. No. That's what we're doing right now, actually, another is working on what we're going to be doing next. So we're reading a lot of plays right now and starting to see kind of what we're going to be doing
you
in
know,
the future.
Here's a question that's probably going to be tough to answer, but what let's just say in the last couple of years, what have been your most successful shows?
Well, there's different ways to look at success, I think. I think they're successful as far as box office and they're successful as far as artistic merit. And I think the play that I would say probably that melded the two the best in our last few years is Golden Boy by Clifford Odets. And Joshua directed that and I designed the set with Tim Wallace. And it was just one of those shows where it's a huge cast of all these men and everyone thought we were pretty crazy to try to attempt it. And thought we were pretty crazy to try to attempt it.
I think what you're referring to is finding all those men.
Finding all the men. Yeah, because everyone's like, oh, and we had these people walk in that were, it was like a dream. And every member of that cast was amazing to
really
work
was,
with.
Yeah.
And was like, it was like they walked off a 1930s film set. I mean,
fun?
It was crazy. And the whole production there was just such a positive thing. And we were selling out like crazy, great critical reviews, the whole thing. So I would say definitely there's a lot of shows that are my favorites. And I have my own personal favorites for different reasons.
Sure.
But I would say overall that Golden Boy, I think, was a real...
Yeah, it was a
real
dream.
Complete experience.
Now, your success with your productions have led you to just recently have the funds to start adding staff.
Yeah.
Tell us about that briefly.
Well, we're thrilled with what we're able to do right now, and that is that we are. I've always been full time with the company, but now we've been able to bring Joshua on full time as our associate artistic director, and we've also hired a full time managing director named Alex Scollin, and that's really exciting for us because his whole emphasis is on the business side. He doesn't even want to be on stage. It's crazy.
Well, I wish I could. You have any volunteers
like
that?
I'm like, wait a second. So there's that, and then we've also been able to increase our box office hours and increase Kelly Iverson, our box office manager, who's fabulous. And we just brought on a technical director, and we have a director of operations. So it's really growing wonderfully. And so much of that is thanks to the support of the city of Carlsbad, mm-hmm. who is sponsoring us into the space that we have. And it's such a great space to be in as well. So we're in a really good position right now, even with the rather scary economy.
Yeah.
We're really lucky to be able to have these positions in place. And we've had some major donors come up to help us sponsor that, like the PC Chow Foundation helped to sponsor our managing director.
Yeah.
So we're, again, just really, really in an exciting, fortunate place right now.
We're talking with Chris Christiane Kerner and Joshua Everett Johnson. I wish I could say your name without stumbling over
That's okay.
it. Christiane Kerner.
There you go.
And your actual title is Artistic Director of.
I'm now the Executive Artistic Director.
Executive Artistic
mm-hmm.
Director.
And I'm the big cheese.
You're the big cheese. you would not be seeing all this success with. Being able to bring these people on were it not for the fact that you were producing artistically reliable stuff. So my congratulations, and I think San Diego and the environs here are very lucky to have you. And we urge people to get up to, how's your subscription base? Is it growing?
It's great, yeah, it's growing each year. It's been growing steadily, and we're getting a ton of new people in once they know that we're there in Carlsbad Village, right across the street from the train station.
Yeah,
that's
all right.
A great place to come.
Thank you so very much for coming here and talking with us today. Don't forget, folks, get out there to see Fool for Love. You go to newvillagearts.org. It closes 10/26. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Here's a look at what's happening at theaters across town. Ion Theater presents Bash and In a Dark, Dark House, both by Neil LaBute, playing now in repertory at the Lab at Academy of Performing Arts in Grantville through November 1st. A Light in the Piazza continues at Lamb's Players Theater in Coronado through November 2nd. Compass Theater opens a new adaptation of Britannicus, with previews starting October 16th in Hillcrest. Talent to Amuse presents Caliban's Island on two weekends only, October 17th through 26th at Swedenborg Hall. North Coast Rep opens Don't Dress for Dinner on October 22nd at the theater in Solana Beach. The North Park Playwrights Festival sees its final two weekends with six new short plays each weekend, October 17th and 18th, and the 24th and 25th on El Cajon Boulevard. And four shows close up shop on October 26th, so get out to see Dying City at Signet, Fool for Love at New Village Arts, The Women, and Back, Back, Back at the Old Globe. That's a look at what's happening. For San Diego Theater Scene, I'm Kelly Lepchinski.
This has been Follow Spot, a podcast service of San Diego Theater Scene Incorporated, a nonprofit organization for the arts in San Diego, California. We invite you to visit our website, sdtheaterscene.com, for current comprehensive news and information about performance activities in San Diego County. Your host for this program has been Dale Morris, assisted by Kelly Lepchinski, who is also program coordinator, and Michael Thomas Tower, who is also engineer and announcer. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to your being with us again soon.